child's bladder anymore.
You know what? You expelled a giant rock, so I don't. I'm sure that fucked some shit up.
It's actually better now, but
yeah,
it's just it does feel more free flowing.
It's good to know. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And you are Cassidy Robinson from L.A.
I am.
Yes, that was very short. I don't have to say other stuff anymore.
Los Angeles, not Louisiana, in case anyone was...
Just in case, yeah.
Thought we were using the abbreviated versions of...
You could say PDX.
PDX?
That's a thing around here, yeah.
Is that really well known, though, like, outside of the Portland area? Is that, like...
No, nothing about... Okay, also, did you know it was Bridgetown?
You explained, like, a lot of
Rose
these
Rose City?
Me. Yeah. I know Rose City.
There's, like, 10 names.
Uh-huh. Today we're going to be talking about Pixar's Inside Out, and at the end of the episode, we are going to review Citizen Ruth. And I forgot to discuss something with you before we started recording.
Well, it's funny because I almost clapped when you started the show.
I know.
I almost did it.
There's nothing really coming out next week. And I have dope in the
can.
In the can, as it were. So if you want to see that, it's out there. I think it's playing on 2,000 screens. So that's a pretty wide limited release.
Oh, yeah. It was at the theater near me.
Oh, okay.
Well, hopefully it'll still be there.
Because next week is, like, barren. It's...
You don't want to see Anybody Can Dance, too.
No. There's Ted 2 is the big release.
Yeah.
And you didn't see the first one. And
seems like there was something else, though, that I was interested
in. There's a movie called Max, which looks like the worst.
I don't think that was the one, but maybe.
It's about a Marine's... Dog.
Oh, the dog, yeah. No, that's cool. Not the one.
Not to be confused with Mad Max Fury Road. I wonder how, back into podcast talk, I wonder how many people will confuse that movie with Mad Max Fury Road.
I was kind of thinking about going to see Big Game.
What's that?
Samuel L. Jackson is the president, and he's defended by a small boy in the forest with a bow and arrow.
I don't believe you.
It's there, man. Look it up. Big Game.
it's like the most dangerous game, but not. Like with feral children?
Well, no. Like, Air Force One crashes.
Right. And
Samuel Jackson is the president. Not like his character is. I don't think him literally. Maybe, though. He basically crashes, and there's this boy that's, like, camping out in the woods by himself. He's probably, like, 10. And, like, all these, like, goons come and try to get the president, and he, like, protects him with his bow and arrow. So sort of like, I don't know. It's the unofficial sequel to Snakes on Planes.
Right, Snake on Planes. All right. So did you do anything fun this weekend? Because I haven't done anything.
I don't do fun things. I read books. That's how I live a life anymore.
What are you reading?
I finished a couple of books recently. I finished Lovers of the Law by Nick Bamatis.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically Nancy Drew with a really nasty punk rock girl from, like, a hardcore punk rock chick from like 89.
Fun. Okay.
But for adults, I should say that.
Right.
And then The Rising by Mr. Brian Keene, who I've become a big fan of as of like last year. It's his like first novel, but it's like it's a zombie, but it kind of has its own like spin to it. And it came out around the same time as the first issues of Walking Dead and 28 Days Later. And
is it a comic book?
No, it is a book.
A wordy. Right. Okay.
And, it's more or less pretty good. It's his first like published novel, but but it was still pretty decent. Like, I mean, for a first published novel, that's more than most people can say. So
yeah, that's true. I mean, what was it? The famed story of Stephen King throwing away his manuscript of Carrie and his wife fishing it out of the trash and publishing it behind his back.
Oh, well, that's, yeah, I forgot about that one. That's true. Mm-hmm. Some people do it.
Right. I mean, it's like one of those, George Washington chopping down the cherry tree type of stories. It's like stuff of legends. I wonder how true that story really is, or if it just sounds good on the back of a soft cover.
Well, yeah, you know, it's maybe a little exaggerated. It wasn't him. It was him dressed up as his wife that got it out of the garbage can.
Right. He actually isn't married. He just has like a whole Tyler Durden weird gender sex thing going on. Okay. The podcast is going into weird zone now.
Which means this is what happens when we don't do things on the weekend.
I know. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. The listeners will have to let us know. Let's go ahead and get into the show. We're going to cover a little bit of movie news, but we actually have a game sort of planned for the pet topic, so we're not going to talk too much about the news. But I have one story here that I thought was kind of interesting. It just came out today. As does happen every so often, Stanley Kubrick, I think I've said this on the podcast before, he's like the Tupac of dead auteurs.
Sure.
Because he created all this content. He was writing all the time. He was always researching something. He had a million different plates spinning all the time. And then he almost never made anything. He had, especially towards the end of his life, was only making film like once a decade or less. But during those long, 10 to 9 year breaks, he was constantly trying to develop a million different things. And he would either lose interest or wouldn't get the funding, or an actor would lose interest or whatever. One of the things he was working on for a really long time was this Civil War epic called The Downslope, which he was researching with a historian from, who knew a lot about the Civil War. And
Civil War reenactment LARPer. Got it.
Sure. I mean, probably. But it was one of those projects that never came to fruition, but it probably had, 13 giant-sized binders full of research materials and treatments inside of it. And it is now being pursued by director Mark Forster, who made World War Z and Finding Neverland. And it's being produced by the same people who were working with Kubrick before he decided to make something else. And I told you there's a lot of components to this story. It is going to be the first of a trilogy, because everything has to be a trilogy now.
Mm.
So Forster's actually only attached for the first part one of these movies, so he may or may not end up doing the other two. That's a lot of information. Do you have any opinion on it?
Oh man. which part subsection B, or which one am I talking about?
Mark Forster to develop Stanley Kubrick's The Downslope.
Mark Forster, which one is that? I can't remember who that is.
I told you in my description when you weren't listening, World War Z and Finding Neverland.
Oh no, we don't want him to do it, do we?
And Monsters Ball. I mean, I like Finding Neverland enough. He's a director I wouldn't call Kubrickian. If that's what they want to do here, if they want to, honor the materials and kind of do like what Steven Spielberg did with AI, and he tried to sort of emulate Kubrickian style,
and it kind of
didn't work. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but here's the thing: is like, just because it's based on his materials doesn't mean that that's necessarily what he was going to bring to it. And that doesn't mean that that's necessarily the best way to tell that story. It could work better with somebody like a Mark Forster, who I would, you know, based upon the few movies of his that I've seen and the few movies that he's made, I would kind of describe as being a lot more kinetic and a little bit more, I don't know, in the field, as it were. He has less distance than Kubrick.
It's not as much as the fly in the cold, detached fly in the wall. It's more,
right.
There's a little bit more of a warmer touch. I would say it's fairly realistic, his touch, Mark Forster, but
when it is, yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, that you're in film land when you're watching Kubrick, but that's not a bad thing. You just know that's where you're at.
Yeah, you're in his in his vision completely. Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, Kubrick's not really a guy that you want to mimic his voice. So, I mean, in general, the idea of it's just kind of like shrug. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the material, with the material, too. Like, I mean, he could have just been compiling a lot. The other guy I was thinking of is the Tree of Life guy.
Oh, Terrence Malick.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah.
I think he's I think that'd be like too much of a good thing. I think that'd be like, you know, that's like brownie with chocolate frosting. You just don't need it.
Well, what I'm saying is he could shoot his the full trilogy and then just have somebody else edit it.
Right.
Because, I mean, he basically does that anyway.
Right. And it would end up being like a completely different thing. It would end up being like the tertiary character who ends up becoming the main character in editing. And then 90% of the dialogue would be thrown out and it'll be, you know, on the fly voiceover that he comes up with. So what's your story?
Oh, my story. So Rob Zombie is going to helm a Groucho Marx biop. Specifically, it's going to be based off of Raised Eyebrows. It's apparently a fairly well-liked biography of his.
Mm.
Biography, not Otto. But it doesn't actually. A lot of people are talking about like, oh, that's so surprising. But if you actually know a little bit about Rob Zombie, he's a huge fan of Groucho Marx, and I mean, he even makes allusions to it in like several of his films. So it's really, to me, it's really not that far out there. And it's like, oh, and honestly, if he kind of keeps his style and what he's going to do with it, what he's done with some of his other films, I think it could be a very interesting kind of foyer into something else, because he does. I'm not always super into his films, but his films always do also have a voice and also do have a style to them that I think is particular and at least interesting. So that's my 2 cents on that.
Yeah, I more or less agree with you there. I think that when you hear the idea of Rob Zombie doing a Groucho Marx biopic, like it's one of those let it sink in for a minute kind of ideas. But you know, based upon the information you already shared that he is a fan, has made references, and I think this would be a really good way for him to explore what his style means, not just that he can employ his style into a different genre, but that, you know, now that he's not working in horror and he doesn't have these immediate tropes to work off of that are, you know, there and dispensable and kind of easy, you know, now he's going to have to really kind of explore what filmmaking means to him in a broader sense.
Well, he did say one thing I thought was interesting is he said, I kind of see it as being Sunset Boulevard-esque in a way. So that's also an interesting place to pull from. So,
and Sunset Boulevard is arguably kind of a horror film in its own way. Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested. I mean, the basic premise of this book is that it's the later years of Groucho Marx. And I guess during his later years, he was kind of less genial. Mm-hmm. And it's from the perspective of this young guy who was working with him as an assistant and you know, sort of got caught up in a strange relationship of, like, hero worship, but also this guy's seriously an asshole.
Well, I also, there's something to do with the wife, too. Like, she was, like, kind of pseudo crazy controlling and stuff like that. So, so I don't know. It could have a lot of fun angles to go at, and specifically through somebody like Rob Zombie. But, yeah, I'm interested to see his style in a different light, I guess.
Yeah, and to see if he really has it in him, because, you know, I would almost kind of... I don't necessarily mean this in a bad way, but I would almost say that Rob Zombie is kind of a kitsch director at this point. And 90% of his work is sort of riffing on other people's work. So with this, it is, I think it's definitely going to be a what do you got kind of situation. Like, you know, what other tricks do you have in your bag?
Right. What story are you going to tell? No, I can agree with that. I don't think you're being mean.
Okay, good. You're not going to tell on me to Rob Zombie?
Well, no. I'm more worried about having to fess up to Stephen King.
Oh, okay.
About strange derailment into that, whatever the fuck that was before. But no. I won't tell on you.
Good.
You won't tell on me.
I'm glad. Let's go ahead and get into the pet topic. We're going to be talking about Inside Out, which is the new Pixar film. And Pixar has become, you know, sort of the ultimate brand in animation now. They are the bar that's been set for a certain kind of three-dimensional animation or computer graphic animation. They were sort of the first. Obviously, yeah, there was, like, commercials and music videos, the Money for Nothing Dire Straits video, you know, so some little, like, tidbits of that happening prior to Toy Story. But when Toy Story came out in 1995, it changed the game of what animation is. And, you know, they bring a lot to it. John Lasseter being there for the longest time, I think he might still be, but he's also working for Disney proper. Disney Animation proper as well. But John Lasseter was kind of the showrunner over there, and he kind of set a bar for storytelling as well. And I think there's always kind of been this idea that you expect quality out of Pixar, which means it's easier to be disappointed, even when they produce work that's probably still better than most of their peers. And it's also raised the expectations from other competing companies like DreamWorks Animation and 20th Century Fox and these other people who are working in animation today, you know,
I would say Laika.
I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. But yeah, them as well. I think you see in animation that after a certain point in Pixar's career, they started to change their game as well. So for this game, we've done this with a few other things before. We're going to talk about our opinions of what is the best Pixar movie, what is the worst, what is the most underrated, and what is the most overrated, because they made a million films. We could review them all, but we won't. And I'm sure there might be some overlap and disagreements on on this list. But let's go ahead and we'll start with, in your opinion, what is the most underrated Pixar movie?
The most underrated?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I thought you were going to go in order and you didn't. And so I've got to explain it through this. So I had a dichotomy. I have two films. One is my favorite, but one I think is better. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think one is my favorite film, but one's better. Anyways, so I'm going to put the one that's my favorite because I think it gets some undeserved kind of like schlack for its other parts. And that movie is Up. Now, everybody agrees that the first 30 minutes is heartbreaking and destroys you and is this strange, like esoteric, like think of the bigger things of life kind of 15 minutes or whatever.
It's probably like 10 minutes. And a lot of people have argued that first 10 minutes is like, in and of itself, a movie within a movie, sort of this perfect little component, this perfect piece.
Oh, it's devastating and beautiful and a lot of things.
Yeah.
But then people, it does kind of get sillier and it kind of gets more, a little bit more lighthearted, thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people kind of give it crap because it gets, because it goes into kind of a different realm. But I it's still this really fun kind of trip into adventure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's whimsical as hell. An old man takes off in his house, you know, and full of balloons. How can you not love that? So I think in that sense, some people kind of don't give it its due credit for the second half being just as fun and just as, I think, interesting and I think it lives up to that first part still.
Yeah.
Now, is that first part like beautiful and great? Yes. I'm not saying that, but I think it gets undeserved crap.
I more or less agree with you. I think that I sort of like it in spite of all of the issues that I think are somewhat valid. You know, it after that first 10 minutes, you know, it does get quite broad and quite high concept. You know, with, we were talking floating houses and talking dogs and you know, weird birds and, you know, and all of this stuff. And it has a plot that kind of feels like it's making itself up as it goes, but I think that the emotional arc is there is so strong, not just because of that first 10 minutes, but also the way those themes are repeated all the way through that. I mean, I remember when I went and saw this, I may have saw it with you. I don't remember, but I remember when I saw it, it like gutted me like 3 times in the movie.
I didn't see it with you because I remember seeing it with, my wife and a friend of hers.
Oh, okay.
And it also, it didn't, my wife didn't cry, but on both sides of her, were two, weepy, sobbing people. So,
right. And, you know, and at its best, Pixar can do that. And I think that there certainly certain parts of that movie are maybe designed for that better than anything else they've done. So that's a good one.
I think that specifically, I guess my only reason is I kind of like going on a journey where you don't always know where it's going to go.
No.
So I'm okay that it's a little like, oh, it goes here. Oh, it goes here. Like, and I don't mind, you know, dogs that find squirrels. It's fine.
Okay. My most underrated Pixar movie. And I truly think this. I think, you know, I've been watching a lot of these, like, videos and lists and reading all these listicles after this movie came out this last weekend. And I'm always surprised by how low A Bug's Life is on these lists. And I'm not going to say that it's the most profound thing they ever made or the most emotional thing they ever made, but I think it's totally solid. It's, I mean, first of all, it's basically Seven Samurai with bugs. So, I'm into that. But even before I had seen a Kurosawa movie, I was into the movie because I think that it you know, I a lot of these articles always say, well, it came out around the same time as Ants and they both kind of suffered for it. And oh, well, next movie. And I think there's a lot more to say about the movie than that, because I saw Ants and didn't really like it as a kid. I'm actually sort of curious to see it again now because I think it was more for a sophisticated audience. But I did like A Bug's Life a lot. And it was, and at that time, there was a second film out of the gate. And yeah, is it as good as Toy Story? No. But I think it's has a lot of fun voice talent. And it, as a story, as a, you know, basic Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven adventure, it totally works. And I like it a lot. It has a little bit of corny humor here and there that I think they're sort of above now. But I still think it's a lot of fun, and I've watched it recently, not like way recently, but you know, enough to have a good opinion about it.
I kind of forgot it existed.
And that's a lot of people.
And that and Ants, both of them. And I was like, oh yeah, that happened when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you the last time I watched it.
I'd say give it a shot, watch it again. And you would be surprised how well it still holds up.
Probably won't happen. You might be right. But again, I have like so little to say. I remember I really didn't like the caterpillar. I remember that.
That's what I'm talking about, the corny humor.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, you know, Caterpillar aside, I think the movie's a lot of fun.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the only thing I can remember, so.
All right, well, next, let's do, what do you think is the most overrated Pixar movie?
Overrated? Oh, that's easy. Finding Nemo.
Really?
Yes.
That is not what I thought you were going to say.
You know what? It's fun. It's colorful. But it's kind of, I don't know. Every time I watch it, that's the only, and I've watched it twice. That's a lot for me.
For an animated film, yes, it is.
I don't know. It just seems bright and colorful, and there's not a lot to it. I don't think any of the emotions hit. I find most of the characters kind of annoying. Especially the second time through. The first time I was like, oh, it was kind of cute. It's got some okay humor here and there, but in general, I don't really see the big hubbub. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty overrated. I think it does kind of tune into like a kid's sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
But compared to some of their other films that kind of do both, that cater to both audience, both an adult sensibility and a child sensibility, I don't think this film does that. And I think it's kind of immature. I said it. I don't really like Finding Nemo.
Here's what I'll say about Finding Nemo. I remember when this movie came out, we were in high school, which both makes us either sound super young or super old, depending on who's listening.
Right.
You could say about anything.
Ridiculous, but
right. Yes. But I remember this coming out. We were in high school, and I remember not wanting to see it specifically. I think by this time, DreamWorks had kind of kicked in. There had been a lot of movies that had come out to me, I guess at the time I didn't have the faith in Pixar to just assume it would be good.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people don't. I don't think a lot of people really remember that Finding Nemo is kind of like a second wind. Like, they had made a few movies, and, you know, Bug's Life didn't make a lot of waves, and I think more or less people really like Monsters, Inc., but it, you know, again, was nothing like as big of a hit as the Toy Story movies. So, and like I said, competition started to flood in. So when I saw, like, the trailers and stuff, I was like, oh, it's just a Bug's Life in the ocean. Like, okay, now we're just doing fish. Woo! What's next? They're gonna do eagles. Like, or whatever. Like, that was kind of... Right. That was a different movie.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, that was kind of my jaded teenage feeling going in. And then I was like totally warmed over by the entire experience. And I saw it at the drive-in when those still existed. And I thought that I really did not expect to like anything about it. And I ended up coming away from it very, very happy. And I have seen it a few times since, you know, I would say recently enough to have a accurate opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And I get where you're coming from. And there's a little part of me that almost wants to put it in the same category just because it is like this standard for Pixar. It's a go-to film when people talk about Pixar, and I kind of don't get why.
Well, that's why.
But I kind of do also.
I don't, I think it's just warm and fuzzy and easy. And I mean, I don't think it's the worst of their films.
No,
obviously. But when you ask people and they're like, oh, Finding Nemo, I'm like, you're just saying that because your child loved it so much. So you have this weird sense of affectation towards it. It's not that good.
I think, again, like A Bug's Life, I think it has a lot of fun voice talent. I think Ellen DeGeneres is a lot of fun in the movie, and it's a good character. And the chemistry between her and Albert Brooks, I think, works well enough to get you through the movie. And it has a kind of a fun adventure, like episodic kind of storytelling to it. But yeah, I think that it is, I would agree with you on the easy. I think it it kind of tells itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of kind of, and it seems almost weird to say it like this because the internet didn't work the same way back then, but it has a lot of kind of meme-ish qualities to right. the movie. There's a lot of quotables in it that kind of come off as like extremely tired by the fourth time you've heard them.
Maybe that's why too. I also have an affectation against it because I just when I hear people quote it,
yeah,
and I've heard people quote it so much that I just want to like.
Since 2003, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to like. there are certain people that I've just wanted to smack in the face and be like, no, not funny,
no more. My most overrated, and again, I wouldn't say it's a terrible movie, or the one that I don't even dislike it, but for my money, the most overrated is Ratatouille.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, well, this is the second one that was directed by Brad Bird. And I remember I caught up with this one way later. Like, a lot of them, if I do see a Pixar movie, generally, if I don't see it in theater first, I'm probably not going to see it. Because it just doesn't come my way after that point. But luckily for me, I usually do end up seeing them in theaters, unless I have no interest. And I should say off the bat, I've never seen any of the Cars movies or Airplanes or any of the spinoffs. But I'd heard so much about Ratatouille before I'd seen it. And it was one of those things where I just couldn't see it or I couldn't catch up with it. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard so much about how good it is and how amazing it is and da da da. And then when I saw it, I was like, it's fun, I guess. There's this whole conceit, and this doesn't spoil it in case you plan on catching up with it eventually. There's this whole conceit that the rat character, voiced by Patton Oswalt, he's able to control a chef's body by tugging on his hair, which apparently like controls different body parts of the chef. So he's able to like puppet the chef into making the best recipes. And like the whole point of this conceit is so that Remy, I think is the rat's name, is able to, you know, use this other body to basically get his best food ideas out there. And I feel like that's such a weird way to go around to getting to this thing happening of him being able to transfer his talent to this guy. Why can't he just like write down the recipe or whisper it in his ear? There's so many things.
Because it's whimsical.
It's
I don't have a hat. I just needed to scream something.
And this is the part of the podcast where everybody yells into their headphones. You're talking rats. What are you talking about? Who cares? Like, obviously it's not real. It's a cartoon, blah, blah, blah. Yes, I will accept talking rats. But there's this concept out there I've heard about called the magic bean theory. And the magic bean theory works as such. You're allowed to use one magic bean. But as soon as you use two, it goes over the line. So the one magic bean I'll allow is talking rats. But as soon as talking rats are also puppeting human beings by pulling on their hair, then I'm like, nope, that's too much. I would say there's about maybe half of Pixar's catalog that oversteps the magic bean theory. But yeah, this that's the one that bugged me the most. And on top of that, I also think that the overall message of the movie, the overall effect of the movie, it has its moments. It's where I kind of get it, but a lot of the times I kind of don't. Again, not a bad movie. I just don't get what the buzz is about.
I didn't see it. It didn't interest me. Maybe I have a bias against Pixar animal movies.
I think maybe that could be it. Yeah. So that begs the question. What is the worst Pixar movie, in your opinion?
This could go a lot of ways for me. Now, I have to also specify that I haven't seen Cars or Planes or any of that baloney.
Right.
We
took their word for it.
Yes. Now, I'm going to have to say for mine, because I'm not actually in love with these movies, and this is where people yell at me, I don't think the Toy Story movies are that good.
Wow. Now,
the one
worst?
Specifically that I don't like that much, it just kind of is. The whole concept is just kind of like, okay. But specifically, I'm not going to say it's Toy Story 2, I think, is the worst. Now, maybe I just didn't connect. Maybe it's just because I don't connect to any of them. But that one just kind of seemed like happenstance stuff happened. And it just, that movie actually seemed very cynical to me. It just seemed like they were trying to put out another sequel to make money off of the Toy Story logo. I didn't really care for it. I don't remember much about it either. But I mean, I think that's kind of the part of the problem. I think that there's an overinflated sense of how great these movies are also. So maybe it should have gone in my overrated. I'm not really sure, but I don't really care for the film.
Okay. I mean, I would agree with you that the Toy Story 2 is the least good of the three.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with you. I would have almost agreed with you that it's sort of a problem film. Had, in my opinion, Toy Story 3 not kind of by being as good as I thought that it was, sort of justify Part 2's existence.
Actually, Part 3 is actually my favorite of all three films. But again, I was still, I still shrugged at the end of it. I was like, okay. I guess. I mean, it sat about the same level, maybe a little better than Finding Nemo, but not much.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I get you, even though I totally don't.
No, I know people think I'm crazy. I just don't like the Toy Story movies. I don't think that they're that good. They don't, like, the characters don't really appeal to me. And I kind of find Woody kind of to be annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the second one, they just the characters didn't evolve very much, and they didn't really do much. They just were kind of there.
It was just another adventure. I think it was. I would agree with you to a certain extent. I think that was, you know, at that point, Pixar hadn't really completely established their brand. Then they had, yeah, I wouldn't call it a flop, but sort of a disappointment with A Bug's Life. So, yeah, maybe they leaned on something familiar and they said, well, you know, Toy Story did really well, even though these movies take a million years to make. So I'm sure they already had it like halfway through production by the time they were even putting out A Bug's Life.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, I kind of get where you're coming from that point of view. I think the movies as a whole, the trilogy as a whole, is maybe one of the most consistent trilogies in cinema. And I think that, you know, the characters...
See, now that, you're going too that, far.
Now so I'm going... No, but...
Too far.
But I actually believe these things. And I think that the characters are what the movies are all about. So, yeah, if you don't like them, you're going to lose a lot out of it. But I also think that Toy Story sort of set into motion the modus operandi of Pixar in general, of, you know, being able to make these grand allegories about life and death and humanity and feelings and all of these things, these kind of complex things, through, you know, easy to understand childhood ideas. And I think that those movies maybe still, in some regards, do it the best. And there is one scene in Toy Story 2 that deals with the new character played by Joan Cusack, the girl cowboy, Jessie. When it goes into her backstory, that like is up there with anything Pixar's done, even if the movie as a whole doesn't stand up as much.
What's that one scene? I have no idea what you're talking about.
It just talks about it's basically a silent, it's almost like the Up sequence in a lot of ways, but it's a song playing in the background by Sarah McLachlan, and then they talk about her backstory and how she was basically her master, whatever, her toy owner, like, grew out of her over years, and it made her cynical as an adult toy, or whatever, they don't really age. That sequence alone, I think, kind of, maybe if it weren't for it, I don't know, I would be easier for me to discredit it, but that's a damn fine 5 minutes.
I vaguely remember what you're talking about. I don't know. It all comes down to whether you like, to me, kind of hinge on how much you like the characters.
Mm.
I wasn't into the characters that much. So I mean, the whole series is kind of... a little lopsided for me. And I think, you know what? I ended up kind of liking the third one because I started to like some of the side characters more.
Mm, some of the newer additions.
Yeah, I was For some reason, I really liked the evil bear in that one. I'm not really sure why, but it was just, it appealed to me.
My least favorite Pixar movie, and I would say with a bullet, is Brave.
Oh, yeah, that's a movie, too.
And one of the reasons why is because I think there was a lot of expectations going into it. And by this time, Pixar had made Cars. I want to say Cars 2 had already come out by this point. And you kind of felt like the brand was starting to get a little tarnished. They made a few good ones here or there, but it seemed like those were kind of fading in the distance by this point. And so when we saw the trailer for Brave, it looked amazing. It was like, yes, this is the Pixar I need. This is the Pixar I want. And it looked like it was going to be this fun, kind of magical, like, adventure movie with, now we have a female protagonist, which we never had before, and she may or may not fight a bear. it was this really kind of intense trailer, and, you know, they've always been really good at marketing, so that's shouldn't be that surprising. But then you see the movie, and the first 20 minutes or so is kind of interesting and kind of fun, and they set up the world really well. And then once they introduce what the conflict of the movie is, you know, people just start turning into bears all over the place. It really, the whole thing feels trite and small and easily resolved, and the stakes are really low throughout most of the movie and kind of uninteresting. It just kind of, like, the movie just gets progressively less interesting by every minute that passes. And by the end of it, I guess I wanted to like it more than I did, but now that I've had more years behind me, it's easily my least favorite of the bunch.
No, I completely agree with all your points. I wouldn't change anything about my order, but I really think that you summed up the experience of that film pretty well. I think it could also go very easily in the most overrated category for how much talk it got and how much people loved it. I feel like
there's a lot of people out there though who more or less see it as a disappointment.
I also think it's faded with time.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's another reason why I didn't immediately come to mind for most overrated, is because I did see a few like blankets and all that kind of like the kind of gear and stuff that comes with it, but then kind of just disappeared into the oblivion. And I to me, it's kind of more in Bug's Life territory. Because to me, it's kind of the same thing, is it just kind of disappeared.
Yeah, there it is.
People just liked it more.
Yeah.
At the time it came out.
Well, I think there were higher expectations for it, which is why I think that it hit a little harder when it wasn't very good. Okay, so what is your favorite Pixar movie? Well, we already said what your favorite is, but what you think is the best Pixar movie.
Yeah, Up is my favorite, but WALL-E, I think, is the best of their films. I think it's the most consistent story-wise. They make you feel stuff with these silly little robots. and also, I mean, just the overall message, like, I mean, you know, it has a lot of ideas in the message, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, what do we do with all this technology? What do we do with all this waste? What do we do with all this, you know? It eventually comes to a standstill, you know. Ooh. And so I think it asks just as many questions as it, and I don't think it necessarily gives us the answers, but it gives you, you know, something to chew on and think on. And I think it's actually maybe not their most, Up is certainly a much warmer film. Probably most of their films are warmer than this one, but I would say overall story, everything like that, I think it's their best one.
Yeah, I think there would be a lot of people in that camp. And it's, you know, I have to confess, I've never seen WALL-E.
I kind of don't know how to feel about that. Kind of like just sitting back and like, okay, cool.
Well, it's not for the lack of wanting. It was one of those ones where I didn't see it in theater. Mm-hmm. And then I had heard so much about how great of a theater experience it is that I never felt like watching it on DVD was going to be, that I was going to get what everyone got out of it. With that said, I mean, sequences that I've seen, we used to play it in the video store in the background. I didn't consider that watching it.
For sure, yeah.
You know, it has some of the best animation.
That's true too.
The visuals, like in the opening sequences, especially like when he's going through the rummage and that kind of stuff, it's very, very tactile and really, really well lit. But it makes for a lot of people's favorites. And it's one of those ones that people kind of their go-to when they talk about Pixar. Although I have heard from some people that, like Up, it's one of those ones that some people believe falls apart by the middle of the movie.
I think it comes back around. It definitely goes somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't say it falls apart. I mean, if you're just invested in one little robot on the planet all by himself, then okay. but it does kind of move the plot along, and it goes to a different spot, basically, like right. physical location. And I could see some people the minimalism and stuff like that, but also the magic bean kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can see it maybe crossing that precipice for some people, just because the joke surrounding specifically the humans future into the film. It's silly, but I think that it does have some practical reasons to be in the narrative, and I think that it does fit in there. And it is some silly humor, but I don't think that there's any Pixar movie that doesn't have some silly humor.
Well,
in it. So I all of that, basically, for what it is, any of its maybe possible misgivings, I can just kind of bury, because I don't think that there's not enough to push the beans over the counter.
Okay, all right. I'm still interested in seeing it. I want to see it on the big screen. And now that I live in LA, I maybe can. Mm. And that's sort of what I'm holding out for. Because I had, you know, Keith had the Blu-ray when I was living with him. And I thought
if
about it.
If you can see it on a big, shiny TV, I think it would be just as good.
Yeah.
It'd probably still be better in theaters. I think I saw it in theaters first. But.
Okay. My favorite Pixar movie. And this was a tough one. This is the hardest one to come up with, I think, because I think I could have... Part of me wanted to just nominate the Toy Story trilogy as a whole, and maybe that would have been cheating.
Cheating.
So I decided that the one that I champion the most, and I end up talking about the most, I think, is The Incredibles, which was the first Pixar outing by Brad Bird. And I think one of my favorites... In general, it was sort of a surprise. Like I knew I like, yeah, superheroes, da da da, but I wasn't prepared for how much I was going to like that movie and how much fun it was. And I think, you know, in this day and age where superhero movies are a dime a dozen, they're being made constantly. I think there's still some lessons to be learned from The Incredibles on how it manages its characters, how it uses its time, how it does world building. How it builds up its villain and uses him. And I think that there's a certain kind of whimsicality, obviously, and it gets silly and all of those things. But it's also, there's a little bit of a melancholy in there. And it's also, it's a Pixar movie about middle-aged crisis.
Well, it's certainly the best Fantastic Four movie we've seen so far.
Yeah, completely. And, you know, I think I remember... the first Fantastic Four movie had come out around the same time, and it just like blew it away as far as, you know, kind of taking upon a very similar concept. It's also the best Watchmen movie we've ever seen.
Sure.
It uses superhero culture in a way that feels like it knows what it's talking about and it's a fan of it, but it also doesn't feel fanboyish and kind of regurgitating and just pandering either. It feels like it's its own thing. And what I've always said, you know, we have three Toy Story movies, we have two Cars movies, and this is the one I've wanted to see a sequel to the most. If any of them, this is the one I think deserves a sequel the most. I love this movie.
Hmm. Well, I it's one of my middling ones, but I definitely can't disagree with anything you've said. Especially I kind of like that. I don't feel like it panders. Mm. It doesn't. It's not look at how much we like superheroes.
Yeah, look at all the comic book references. Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's very much its own world, and it's very much its own thing, and the fact that they built it off of its, you know, a fairly generic superhero idea, which frankly, because every superhero under the sun has basically been done, you can't escape those grounds. It's just about building your best characters, your best narrative, and your best story you can tell. So, and I think that Incredibles specifically does those things, like, and did everything that you said. I would put it barely above Monsters, Inc. for me. Like, again, it's one of the middling ones for me, but I do think it's pretty good.
Yeah. Monsters, Inc. it almost made my overrated list just because there's a certain kind of quality to that movie. Like, it's one of those ones where it's like, had really great setup and you had a really, this fun characters. And I like the idea of like a corporation for monsters. And then the whole thing's about helping a toddler.
Mm-hmm.
And I, for that reason, I'm kind of less interested in that movie, but I'm also less offended by it. Like, I'm fine with the people who like it as much as they do.
I think the humor in Monsters, Inc. also kind of
saves it.
I don't think saves it. I think actually kind of wears on you after a while. At least me. But that's my only 2 cents about that. So.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into Inside Out, which is the new Pixar film. And we were talking before we started the show that, it came in at number 2 over the weekend because Jurassic World's still making buttloads of money. But it came in at number 2 at almost $100 million, which is nothing to scoff at.
Yeah. And I mean, also, it's only its first weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised by the Jurassic World thing, because I mean, I thought it was fun, but oh my gosh, like, that fun? Not really. but I mean, yeah, 91, to have two movies making like close to 100 million, that hasn't been happened for a lot of summers. It's actually kind of, I actually am kind of happy it happened.
Yeah, it means it was a well-attended weekend.
Exactly. Yeah. So it means that there is some precedence for people still going to the cinema. You just have to trick them to going for whatever reason.
And maybe in some cases, a lot of people seeing both movies over the weekend, maybe seeing Jurassic World again and then seeing Inside Out, which is really hard to make people do.
Yeah.
Sure. So this movie is kind of this is one of their original ideas. It's not a sequel or based on something we've seen from them before. The basic concept is there's a girl named
Riley.
And inside her head, she has all of her emotions. We have joy and sadness and fear and anger, and they sort of create the alchemy of what is a person's personality. And they each control their own thing, and they all have their own purpose for what they do with Riley. Joy sort of initiates herself as the leader of the group, for better or worse, and the movie argues that maybe Joy shouldn't be the leader of anyone's emotions. But she's sort of the most outgoing, and she usually makes Riley the most happy, obviously. But her and Sadness kind of end up getting separated from the rest of the group, which ends up causing a lot of emotional trouble in our main character, Riley. And they have to make it's one of those Pixar plots where somebody from a group gets separated from the rest of the group, and they have to get back to the group. We've seen that plot repeated a lot in Pixar movies. But they use it really, really well, I think. And we have a lot of fun voice talent. Amy Poehler, Phyllis Smith, who a lot of people might not recognize her voice when they're watching the movie, but she was one of the main cast members from The Office, The American Office. Bill Hader is in there as Fear, and Lewis Black, probably the most recognizable voice in the cast as Anger, and Mindy Kaling as Disgust. And I think this has a lot of the stuff we like Pixar movies for. But before we, you know, dig deep, what did you think of it?
As of today, I would actually say this is the best Pixar movie.
Wow.
This destroyed me as a person. Like, I walked out of the theater still feeling emotions and felt them for several hours after. I can't name any film almost that's done that to me that much. Maybe thought about, maybe, you know, pontificated on, but nothing that gave me the feels so much. I wasn't ready to be a 13-year-old girl. I just wasn't ready for that experience. But I, you know, her story, even though it's like, it literally is like two movies kind of happening. Mm-hmm. You have this really just like simple, like life story happening, but yeah. Then the chaotic world of emotions and memories and stuff that go on the inside.
Sure.
And I just found maybe the plot is fairly simple, but I think it's to its benefit.
Yes.
Because you're talking about some, just some heavy, heavy, huge, like that go on inside of us, you know? Mm-hmm. And I honestly, how the ideas play out and how they show, you know, not just the emotions inside her head, but other people's head, mm-hmm. and how they kind of function and work. And I mean, kind of to give you an idea of how a person is made, it's an excellent fucking film. Mm-hmm. Like, again, I don't know if I've ever had the feels this much in a movie. I don't know if it's just because it's so like, just like,
well, the movie's about emotions. Center. Yeah,
it is. But that doesn't mean like, but I mean, it doesn't mean you can connect to it. Like I could understand and I could feel, you know, I really connected to this character and this girl. And my review is going to be pretty glowing. I'm not going to lie.
No,
I want to give it a few days just to kind of like maybe get away from it and see if, you know, or maybe even a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that this one's going to just keep growing and becoming more interesting and more profound. I also, this is the only movie of Pixar's that I've ever been like, yeah, I'd love to see a sequel.
Oh, interesting. Because I liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. Immensely. And I liked it more as it played out. Unlike something like Brave, or a lot of their movies where you can complain that the second half doesn't pan out as well as the first. I feel like this movie is almost the opposite. When I saw it, I was like, okay, you know, cute, colorful characters, you know, animation-wise, it's maybe a little less ambitious than we've seen from them before, because they're kind of working with more just shapes and colors rather than creating a lot of textures and or taking on something like what does the ocean look like or what does fur on an animal look like, you know, those kind of things. Here, it's a lot more just about creating these kind of brand new ideas out of whole cloth.
I liked that elemental,
right,
feeling, that elemental, like, but you're right, it did come with time.
Right, exactly. I think that the movie, you know, if you look at the basic story of it, both stories that are happening kind of simultaneously, Riley's story, her moving from Minnesota to San Francisco and having to move in a smaller house because the rent's so high there. And, you know, just it's a very basic kind of moment in a lot of children's lives, the moving away from everyone you know and everyone you love. And kind of the shock that can bring to a young person. And there's been plenty of stories that have used this exact same inciting incident to tell a whimsical children's tale. But, you know, this kind of inner space, you know, this is like the way better version of like Osmosis Jones.
Right.
Like, this kind of this idea of like taking what's happening inside her mind and like exploring these characters and sort of what they mean to how a person develops. And there's actually some really complicated, and some might argue too complicated, storytelling going on here. And I'm not talking about the how the characters get from point A to point B kind of storytelling. That's fairly straightforward. But I'm talking about the mechanics of their world building. There's a lot of shoots and ladders that are going on here of about, well, this means this and this does this. And the reason this happens is because we have this thing that does this. And what's actually kind of amazing about this movie is within all of that, within all of this stuff, which the more world building you do and the more rules you build into your world, the more you can potentially stifle emotions out of your movie.
Mm-hmm.
This never does that. It does it so gracefully and deals with exposition so casually that you're constantly engaged with the emotional story. And the
characters. I never had the, just to comment on yours, I never had that check mark, oh, exposition time. I never had.
Yeah, you're never like, okay, blah, blah, blah. I mean, there is, I think there's some voiceover and kind of stuff in the beginning when she's like, oh, this is my favorite land. This is Goofy Land. And it also, I was kind of thinking during that part, I was like, oh, these are going to be actual places you can go to at Disneyland in 2 years. Like, they could be setting up a whole section of Disneyland right now. But no, I think though I too was just overwhelmed almost by it. And it isn't like, it doesn't have that like same kind of crushing sadness of, of Up or towards the end of Toy Story 3 or that moment in Toy Story 2, those moments that people talk about of just like, you know, totally slaying you. It's kind of an accumulative thing in this movie, and it's the all of the emotions. I mean, you feel so kind of filled with warmth at times, and you feel so kind of like you really feel for this character. It's kind of amazing. This is probably my favorite movie I've seen this year.
Well, it's very consistent too.
And it made me kind of like happy about the world and cinema. And I was like, yes, there is some joy left in movie making. It's not just about making money, even if you're going to make a big movie.
I didn't have any of those. I was completely into the mind like thing and just, I was there. There was no, that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I just got home and was kind of emotional wreck of going up and down and, no, but I mean, the story is sort of like profound. Like, it uses that buddy concept that is fairly familiar in these Pixar movies,
mm-hmm.
but it uses it as a device to really talk about some, you know, about how sadness and joy, the mix of those memories, you know, really, you know, mm-hmm. helps you grow up. Because I never moved out of my hometown when I was a kid, but I could completely relate because I went to new schools and you were at some point you were the new kid.
Yeah.
It was too good. Like, I mean, I'm serious. This film, again, I don't know if it's just like the feels is what made it so enjoyable. I mean, but even a character like Bing Bong, which I would really hate in any other movie.
In the context that he's used, he's very, I mean, we should explain a little bit. He's during their journey, their kind of Alice in Wonderland journey back home, they run into one of Riley's old imaginary friends that she's kind of forgotten about over time. And he's voiced by Richard Kind, who was a kind of a popular television actor. He was in Mad About You, and he was in the Coen Brothers movies, The Serious Man.
But he specifically, like, that character,
mm-hmm.
like, the way it paid off and how he was a part, an integral mm-hmm. part of the plot and the structure, that's what made that work.
Well, it's one of those great surprises where, you know, during the marketing, they never gave away that character.
No.
They never, like, showed his best lines or we weren't ready to expect that. So, it was fun to get him as a character, and then B, to see how it plays out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great, if they're going to hold something close to their chest, he was a great thing to do for that. Also, it's really funny. I think one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie, and it's not even the most dramatic beat of the film, is when Fear is watching the TV monitors for when Riley's dreaming. And there's a sequence where, you know, basically in this world they've built, the dream factory is like a Hollywood. And so you get a little bit of kind of meta inside baseball kind of stuff going on there. But it's pretty funny how some of those scenes play out.
Yeah. Totally. The whole Dream Studios,
yeah.
if you will, it was a very, I don't know, like a lot of the whole thing, just, I don't know why, but I'm having a hard time like even getting over it right now. I don't want to even talk about it, Cassidy. You're hurt. It's like being punched in the heart. I don't like it. Like, there's almost a tinge of that
mm-hmm.
for me, but.
Well, and one of the reasons I said I was surprised by your initial reaction was you said this is one of the ones you would want to see a sequel to. And as much as I like it, and I do a lot, I don't really see the sequel potential here. To me, this feels very much like a one-off. Because we're dealing with this one character and these characters who live in this character.
But I think you can do... I think that it has a potential. And, like, you don't have to stay with that character. Like, since we already have the baseline set out with joy, sadness, fear, anger, disgust.
Yeah.
You know, you have a baseline of these emotions in this world you can play in. But you can set that in anybody's head.
Yeah, and we do get to see sort of everyone's... a few different people's versions of those characters.
And I guess that's where it left me wanting more.
Yeah.
Like I did like seeing in other people's heads and
it hints at a bigger world. Yeah.
Well, it hints at the bigger world, but it also hints at the variations. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's something that's very, I don't know. This is magical. This was a magical experience.
Richard has devolved into a child.
I really have. I don't even know. How did you feel about Jangles?
Jangles?
The clown?
Oh, that was... I really like the way that played out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, I mean, all along the journey, it kept surprising me with new things and new ideas and new specificities about this world. And even though it was basically a we got to get back to Andy's house kind of story... it played out so well.
Yeah, there's a level of depth that you just... and consistent depth that I haven't experienced in any of their films. And just, just consistency throughout the whole thing.
Right.
Say much more. I love the film.
I did too. And as soon as I saw the movie, mm-hmm. I don't do this very often, especially with kids' movies. As soon as I saw the movie, I texted my older sister, who has a... child. They go to movies somewhat often. They usually ask me what I thought about something if I've seen a kid's movie. And I texted them before they even asked me. I was like, take Emma to go see Inside Out. It's the best movie of the year so far.
Well, that is one question. Like, I wonder how kids will, you know, react to it. Because is it because, like, we can go back and have that nostalgia towards that period of our life? Like,
I think it's going to work all around. I think, you know, I can only... speculate because I'm not a child, but
yeah.
I think there's enough there with the characters, with the world, with the colors, you know, the simplistics of the story, that I think it's going to work on the level of entertainment for children. It's going to be an electric babysitter just fine. But I think it's
sure.
Like the best children's films, it'll grow with you, and when you see it again and again, you'll get more out of it. And I think, you know, if Pixar's known for anything, it's that.
I think you're right. I think that makes sense.
All right. Well, let's now for something completely different. Let's get into our Netflix homework, which is Alexander Payne's first film. Came out, I think, 1996 or 1995, Citizen Ruth. Mm-hmm. And I'll let you set that up.
Okay. Citizen Ruth. It's basically about this drug addict who gets pregnant. And, well... she ends up getting court ordered to have an abortion, but she gets saved by anti-abortions. And then there's a war between the pro-life versus pro-choice. And that's basically the film plays out and kind of, I would say in an annoying sort of way, kind of plays out, kind of over examines and states both positions. I will say that it's fair to both sides. So I kind of like that. I don't know. There's something about this film that really was annoying to me.
I don't completely disagree with you.
And I have a problem putting my finger on it because, honestly, it was so annoying that I, like was having a hard time, like, just, like, paying attention to it. Mm. I found it kind of insipid. Again, there were things to like about it. Like, I think you can definitely see where he started to get his storytelling kind of, how good he is at those kind of just basic, just very... slice of life kind of stories.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't have ever watched this film, which it is a first film, and I think for a first film it's decent. It just, I don't know, it just didn't, it had a lot of good points, and I thought it was kind of good that it was about something, but it just didn't, I don't know, it just annoyed me throughout. Like the whole time I just wanted to be like, I do not want to watch this anymore.
Was it because it was
I wanted to change the channel? but it was the, but I, you know, it wasn't that kind of a, it wasn't that kind of an option.
Right. Well, is it because it was too on the nose?
It was often too on the nose. Yeah. I mean, sometimes that kind of the humor is nice, but I mean, I didn't, I mean, I thought that Laura Dern was good in it, but her character was just obnoxious and kind of maybe a little over the top. And maybe, maybe the thing is too, is like, he likes comedies, but he didn't really know how to do his type of comedy yet. And so he did kind of a goofball thing. It also kind of feels vaguely like Fargo-ish. Like, it wanted to kind of go that route, but he just can't do those kind of characters. And I just kind of, I don't know. I really didn't like this movie. Like, I think there's things to laud about it. And I think it's interesting to see from a director that I kind of like. But it, all in all, I just kind of was like, by the time it was over, I was like, oh, thank you.
I kind of get where you're coming from. I don't dislike it as much as you do. In fact, I would even say I kind of like it, but I do agree with you that a lot of it is very on the nose. It's very much about what it's about. And I think that a lot of the characterizations throughout the movie of either the pro-lifers or the pro-choicers are really reductive in a way that's kind of not helping anyone's argument. In a way that's not really saying anything new or helpful or interesting or nuanced about anything.
Sure.
And the fact that he includes both stereotypes and and then plays both stereotypes against each other is supposed to balance everything out. But in a way, it just kind of creates a negative. Like, it's just a, you know, positive charge, and a positive charge creates nothing. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of an oddity of a film in a lot of ways. There's certain things about it from just a storytelling perspective that I kind of am impressed by, more for its audaciousness than for its execution. I think, you know, the fact that his first film out, he wants to cover this topic, you know, the political rallying behind the abortion topic, and then to make a comedy out of it, a satire, which is, this is a topic even to this day, and maybe even more so now than then, people just don't even want to come close to approaching in any fashion, let alone a comedy. So in that sense, you know, it is kind of refreshing just to see someone going for it and going
especially
there.
Like 1996. I mean,
right.
Maybe it was right at the, it was kind of at the edge of the kind of the independent
film kind of movement. Thing, yeah.
And so it kind of makes sense that it could exist. And you could almost kind of say it's kind of, no, maybe I don't have enough like clues into this, but I would say it's kind of like in the Juno realm, that kind of area, and kind of Juno would be a better version of this film.
Well, yes and no. I think it depends on what aspect of the story you're telling. I mean, in Juno, I actually think that the abortion topic, which is almost kind of avoided in Juno. I think they approach it and then run from it as fast as they can. Whereas this movie really just like goes for it, and it doesn't completely work. I'm not going to try and argue that it does. I think it goes for it, and you know, it comes with all the, you know, walking on hot coals that comes with going for a topic like this. Also, I think it's kind of interesting to watch in the aspect that the second film that Alexander Payne would make would be Election, which is also a very biting satire.
I've never seen that, so that is one thing that I was kind of curious about.
Well, Alexander Payne, as he's gone on, has become a softer and softer director. And not necessarily, I don't mean that in a bad way, I just mean, like, he's become a lot more warmer towards his characters. When he first started out, his movies were a lot more kind of nihilistic and a lot more kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Misanthropic.
Okay.
And I think Election is a lot better at doing that. And it, you know, by kind of taking teen genre and then like flipping it on its head through his perspective, I think, you know, it's kind of in a similar way. It's almost like seeing Bottle Rocket and then seeing Rushmore, like somebody really kind of coming into their own after having an interesting but maybe not the best start.
Well, I do agree. I don't think this is complete throwaway, but it's more interesting in the fact that it was Alexander Payne's first movie than it was as a movie. If I would have just saw this, I would have just dismissed it completely. Specifically, I do like the one kind of interesting, I guess, idea that I liked that kind of played out was about the actual Ruth character, the person in the middle, and being kind of torn apart by these two sides, and kind of really her position in it, her actual position in the midst of these two kind of zealotries. I find that sort of interesting, but it was just done so obnoxiously that I couldn't focus on anything.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things, again, one of the reasons why I'm kind of like, the movie as a whole doesn't work, but one of the reasons I want to praise it more than maybe it deserves is because the audaciousness, again, of having a character, your main character, you're supposed to be following this person, and he purposely makes her not likable in really any way.
Right.
Like, you know, and Laura Dern completely goes for it, as she is, you know, to do in most movies. She puts 110% into it, and she put 110% into an unlikable character who never changes, who never has, you know, that moment of aha, who never, you know, she is, you know, dumb white trash and kind of is not even out for her own best interests. But I think the argument that the most interesting argument isn't necessarily the abortion argument, which, you know, takes up 90% of the movie. I think it's more this kind of subtext that kind of boils up from underneath that argument about poverty. And I think that ends up, you know, maybe an older Alexander Payne would have mined that a little bit more.
Well, I think you would have definitely done it in a warmer light. And I think there's a connection you feel closer to his characters in the film. So you're more willing to accept, I think, some of his other ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I see what you're saying about it being ambitious in a way, but I don't think that ambition pays off. So again, if it wasn't attached to, you know, this was just Joe Smo, I wouldn't care.
Mm-hmm.
I would kind of just shrug my shoulder at this movie. Again, it's nothing about the argument or anything like that. I see your points. I just don't. I don't think it adds up to enough to really say, oh yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
It just adds up to a point where it's like, oh, this is kind of mediocre.
I think it is remarkable, in the sense that how much he grew between as a director and as a storyteller between Citizen Ruth and Election, because in my view, Election, especially on a screenplay level, is almost a perfect film.
Well, I think that also that this is your more typical movement through film, or probably any kind of creative endeavor that kind of takes an amount of time. Is I think that your first one kind of usually is kind of a shit show because you haven't experienced it ever.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the second time you can kind of take the bit and pieces that you screwed up and but then add the parts that you did well.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always kind of curious to see people's first films, but I think that they usually most people's is going to end up in this category.
Yeah.
And I don't think I don't think it's a mark against anybody, but I think definitely people should check out people's first films, you know, kind of support a new one, whatever. But this one specifically, like I can go back and watch Bottle Rocket.
Yeah,
I agree
too.
With you that it's not as good. I could not go back and watch this.
Yeah, I don't know. I would maybe only watch this again if it was like in a programmed in a festival or something, like, you know, like a retrospective or something like that. It's not entertaining enough on its own just to watch for funsies.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's a big.
No, it is a
big detriment to it, and I think trying to recommend it to somebody, I wouldn't recommend it to somebody.
I would say,
if you have a similar sensibility to what I have, don't watch it. It's just not really that fulfilling. If you are an Alexander Payne, which is kind of the reason why I took it on, well, and because it's part of the Netflix homework, but. I think if you're a completist, which I am as well, I still would have watched this film eventually.
Yeah. Agreed. What do you have for me next week?
Next week, we're going to try to take a turn, and we're going to do The Boys from Brazil. It has stuff to do with Nazis. And that's always exciting.
Yeah, it's good.
Or depressing, either way.
It's good to reach back in the back catalog a little bit and see something from an older decade every once in a while. Yeah, we can do that one. And if anybody has anything they have to say about anything we talked about today, maybe you disagree with us on our ranking of the Pixar movies, or I'm sure you hotly disagree with a lot of what we said. You're welcome to email us and argue with us if you like at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can find us on Twitter at jabberpodcast. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. And if you're there, please leave a star rating and a one sentence review. We're also searchable under the Zune and Windows Podcast Network and Pocket Cast. You can find my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I was kind of getting lazy there during the whole move and everything, and I hadn't posted them, but I just put them all up the last couple days, mostly because I wanted to put up my Jurassic World review. Then you can also read Richard's stuff that he does at his blog occasionally at rdwally.weebly.com.
You could even say rarely would probably be a better word.
You can read the articles and reviews I've written for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Actually, just took a screener from them recently, so I'll have a review up next couple weeks. And be sure to listen to our friends out there, Brad and Amanda and Alyssa, over at their podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, quartercrisis.podbean.com, and Leland over in dampercast.com, and Patrick over at Make Dad Read Comics. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.